This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's Friday, which means it's time for the Week in Review. So let's start with GE. The company is moving its headquarters to Boston, yes, and this week it also announced it wants to be a leader in corporate philanthropy. GE says it'll donate $50 million to education, healthcare, and diversity initiatives in Boston and Massachusetts. GEOCE Jeffrey Immelt says Boston's worth it.
If you look forward 20 or 25 years and the industrial internet takes place, can Boston be what Silicon Valley has been on the consumer internet, or what Seattle has been with Amazon and companies like that? They've been transformed over the last 25 years. I think that potential exists for Boston as well.
Well, on the same day Immelt came to town this week, protesters gathered in opposition to GE. Here's Cole Harrison of the Massachusetts Peace Alliance on Monday.
It's peanuts to them. They have hundreds of millions of dollars stashed overseas that they won't pay taxes on. And for them to get $50 million is an insult.
And we should note GE is also receiving a sizable tax incentive from both the city and the state. So who's getting the better deal? Let's discuss with Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, it's great to have you back.
How are you?
I'm doing well. I mean, I've been scratchy voiced all week, but beyond that, I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. Dante Ramos, also a columnist for the Boston Globe. Good to have you back as well, Dante.
Great to be here.
All right. So first, let me just get a quick hit from both of you on your take on GE's pledging $50 million to Boston and Massachusetts for philanthropy, Renee.
It feels like shut up money to me a little bit.
Oh, you're coming out swinging today.
You know, they're getting $145 million in incentives. And now they're going to throw $50 million because there's been so much hue and cry about this deal. And this is a way of just getting people to back off. Look what we're going to do. We're going to help the schools. We're going to give this money. But I don't think it's really impressing people at this point.
Okay, Dante?
I would put it a little bit differently. I still think it's problematic. What you see is essentially, as Renee said, they've gotten significant tax breaks for being here. Then they also get credit PR-wise for making these donations. And just as a matter of tax policy, it's a little bit strange in that they sort of selectively get to decide what causes they're going to contribute to here in Boston. And, you know, corporate giving, that's you know, kind of a fixture of our philanthropic landscape. But at the same time, it's, you know, most of us who are taxpayers here in Boston don't get to decide, well, you know, we're going to support the schools, but not the elections department at City Hall. I mean, you end up tossing your money into the kitty. And it, you know, it's a strange concept of corporate citizenship that they get to pick and choose.
Okay, so I don't want to end up making myself the GE defender today, but let me ask, what if this is... Okay, it's all hypothetical, but what if this is just a start? I mean, it sounds like neither of you are terribly impressed even with this as a start. I mean, GE's also making the bigger gesture of coming here, and we've had lots of discussions about all the attendant benefits to Boston and Massachusetts for GE's actual even presence here with its corporate headquarters.
Well, look, yes, you know, they're making the bigger gesture by coming here, but they're getting $145 million to come here. Yes, time will tell if this is just the beginning of their philanthropy. But at this point, it seems like very little, given what they're about to get. And, you know, it's been very interesting listening to the mayor's response to this. I mean, he was interviewed by a Channel 5 reporter yesterday, and the first thing he said was, I tell people, be careful what you write because it's going to end up in the press. And that's the situation here. And I thought, that's what you're concerned about? The fact that these emails got out, not the way your citizens are reacting to this deal, which seems overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Sante?
Look, I think it's great that GE is coming here. I hope that their corporate giving, that this is just the beginning of their corporate giving. It is the case that GE is good at a lot of things, one of those being tax minimization. This is what they
right.
do for a living. You know, one disadvantage government is always in negotiating with companies is that, you know, the people who are making these types of deals, these are all ad hoc types of situations, whereas GE, in every jurisdiction they're in, on some level, they are looking to minimize their tax exposure. So, I mean, quite literally, they do this for a living. We the public entities do not. So there is a disadvantage there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so you mentioned the emails, Renee, and it's an excellent point because of the emails that have been released, we now know that the city initially wanted to give, what, $8 to $12 million in tax breaks,
right.
ended up giving GE... $25 million, and then the state, the additional $120 million in grants that could be put forward. So they went much further than they originally had proposed to GE.
Well, the emails are really fascinating because you're seeing all the sort of backdoor, you know, wheeling and dealing, and you know, it's been sort of a revelation to people just the kind of money we're talking about, but also the somewhat jocular tone in these emails about this money at a time when people feel like that money could be much better spent on the MBTA, on Boston schools, on lots of services that people immediately need help with. So I think that's been really interesting. But I can understand why the mayor is upset that those emails got out. But that's not the problem here. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the emails were written to begin with about this issue.
Dante?
I wouldn't begrudge people talking about stuff in a jocular tone. We probably need more jocular tones in public life. But I think there is a certain level of... I wouldn't exactly call it buyer's remorse, but in terms of people examining what was given to GE, a lot of what's been said since then is since the deal was announced is that suggests that the city may not have had to donate as much as they or had to offer as much as they ended up ended up giving.
You know, the other thing that I noticed in the emails, which was interesting to me, is regarding the property taxes that the site where GE is going to put its headquarters could generate. The Globe says that that property could generate some $48 million over the 20 years that the company is getting its tax break. So a net of about $23 million. That's according to the Globe. But of course, it's also difficult to say exactly how much that money would be because right now we can't really parse out the taxes that the city is getting from the parcel because it's owned a larger chunk of it's owned by Procter & Gamble. So there's still all these unanswered questions about what the full-blown financial windfall is going to be going on into the future.
Look, it would be great if everyone who's opposed to this is proven wrong. And that GE turns out to be a great partner for the city and the state, and it all goes well. But right now, people are just looking at the numbers, and they're not really impressed, again, as I've said, with what they're seeing. You know, I hear you, Dante, on the jocular tone, but what it reminded me a little bit of was Bridgegate in New Jersey and those emails that were going around with Chris Christie's aides and just how funny it was that people couldn't get to work and couldn't get home because the bridges were all backed up. You know, it's really hilarious when it's not affecting you. So when you have the city assessor saying something like, I wish I had a multinational corporation to relocate to Boston, I mean, yeah, it's funny, but is it really funny? It's not that funny. Not, again, when you're talking about these kinds of dollars when the city has other services that need to be addressed.
Well, I think the fact that it was the assessor making those jokes is actually telling, too. I don't mean to parse the meaning of humor here, but it is interesting But it is interesting that that was a kind of humorous protest, if you want, from someone who deals with property values all the time and probably has a little bit more of a sense than most people in the city of how much of a favor was being done.
Yeah. Well, as much as we could talk more about parsing humor regarding GE, let's move on and talk about rent, and in fact, not about the potential free rent that GE might be getting for its new corporate headquarters. I want to talk more about residential rental prices because maybe there's some good news here that rents in Boston are leveling off or maybe not rising as quickly, although it may not actually have to do with the entire cross-section of the Boston rental market because lots of new development has come online that's at the high end, and that's where we're seeing most of the leveling off. So first of all, Renee, let's get your take on this.
What I found really interesting was there was this need to make this into a kind of good news story. You know, hey, prices are up, but not nearly as up as they were. Well, to me, it's like saying, the sun, the surface of the sun used to be 10,000 degrees. Now it's only 9,000. Well, guess what? You still can't touch it, you know? And that's what I feel like with rentals. Like, I'm glad it's not up 6% as it was last year, but you're still talking about rents in Boston that are averaging over $2,000 a month. And that is just beyond the reach of a lot of people.
Yeah.
There's all of the data points that we have in front of us suggest that we're just not building enough housing. Mm-hmm. And there were 3,800 apartments that were added this year, in the last year, 3,800 apartments were added. The thing to know is that Boston has been adding nearly 10,000 people a year, just every year for the last 5 years. So we're really just you know, scraping the surface of what's needed. A lot of the construction, almost all the construction, is happening at the high end. It's expensive to build at the lower end. And so we're in a situation where maybe things are, demand is almost being satisfied in at the highest part, but it's really not being satisfied anywhere else.
Right. So to me, that's one of the takeaways. It's like, oh, look, market forces work at the high end. And in fact, we talked to Barry Bluestone about this exact issue this week. He's, of course, at Northeastern. Here he is on Radio Boston earlier this week.
Developers know how to build two kinds of housing. They know how to build luxury housing because there are people out there who will afford the rents or the condo prices. And they know, some of them know how to build housing for the very poor because they can get subsidies. It's the great vast middle. They cannot find a way to build it given land costs, the soft costs of zoning, the costs of land acquisition. So it's not possible to build at the present time. And until we find a way to do that, rents are going to continue to rise for most people.
For most people, right, Renee? I mean, it's back to your, like, you can't touch the sun analogy.
You know,
there.
I feel like if I had a dollar for every luxury condo being built, I could afford a luxury condo. No, that's the sign you see. Luxury rents, luxury this, amenities. But what about everybody else?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what about those people who fall into that category between $50,000 and maybe $125,000 a year? There's nothing for them.
Yeah.
You know, they can't afford to buy, and increasingly, they can't afford to rent in Boston.
And it feels like every time we talk about housing, we come back to this issue that, you know, it's once again, it's a microcosm of the bigger issue of the squeeze of the middle class again and again and again. Dante, go ahead.
What I was going to say is that the fact that luxury housing is being built, in that it looks to people like only luxury housing is being built, that's really telling about how difficult it is to build here in Boston. Because if, you know, as Barry's comments in that clip suggested, if there was a way for people to build, the $300,000 two-bedroom condominium economically, someone would do it because there is a massive demand for it. People really want that product, and it's impossible to put out there. Meanwhile, what we're seeing is demand barely being satisfied at the high end at a time when we are at the top of the biggest development boom in Boston in decades. You have a lot of price-insensitive buyers, you know, Chinese and Norwegian investors buying into some of these new developments. And even at that point, it's still a challenge to get some of these projects financed. So, you know, we have a cost problem. We have a a situation where the zoning, the cost structure, people's wanting to control what is built near them ends up making it impossible to build the amount of housing that we need.
Right. So you mentioned the Chinese and the Norwegians. So did Barry Bluestone when he talked to us.
We have a lot of people from other countries who are parking their money here. Norwegians, who are rich on oil and gas until recently. The Chinese, Russian oligarchs. They're coming here and they're buying up real estate because it's a safe, what they see is a safer investment than the investments they have in China or Russia.
So global economic forces at play here. But, you know, I also last week had breakfast with someone who spent a lot of time in sort of big time real estate development. And he very frankly told me that one of the issues is that investors who would happily build in the affordable zone if they could, affordable zone in quotes, basically the matter of the fact is that they don't see the rate of return there because of all the structural problems that you were talking about. And he said, look, they want a 6% return on their money, and they can't get it when the cost of construction is so high, when it takes so long for permitting to go through that the money could be used elsewhere, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He wasn't saying it's right or wrong. He's just saying that every investor under the sun he's ever worked with, that's their required rate of return. So if we don't take care of these structural problems, all the money that could go into building affordable housing is just never going to go there.
But what it feels like is that the middle class keeps getting excuses. We want to help you, we just can't. You know, we want to do this, but there's all these global issues to be considered. In the meantime, Boston is turning into a city that's going to be unrecognizable.
Yeah.
Boston, I don't know how it sustains itself as being one of the most expensive rental markets in the country. No, that's not a badge of honor.
Right. Part of me wanted to just ask him, well, I did, why don't you just drop your required rate of return, right? If it's good for society, you don't need 6% necessarily.
Would 4% kill you?
All right. Well, did you want to say something else?
No, I was just going to say, not to defend the nameless developer you were having breakfast with. But
he's a very good guy.
One of the problems they're running into is if most of these developments are being made with other people's money, and if you are – you know, building housing with other people's monies, you have to kind of abide by their conditions. And if we make things so difficult to build housing in Boston that only these cream of the crop type projects will make that return, then nothing other than that is going to be built. And sometimes not even that'll be built.
Yeah. So let's move on now, if we can, to a couple of stories concerning Governor Charlie Baker. First of all, the Massachusetts Office of Campaign and Political Finance has determined that Governor Baker can use federally raised funds for state campaign activities. Now, back in 1998, a state law banned the use of federal funds for state political activities, but the Office of Campaign and Political Finance, as I mentioned, announced after a 10-month review, they found federal campaign finance law preempts state law. Okay, so wonk alert here. But first of all, Renee Graham, what's your response to this announcement? What effect could it have on state politics?
You know, this is great for politicians, but it's absolutely lousy for voters and transparency, because what the system really needs is more unchecked, untraceable money. This is a terrible idea. This is a terrible ruling. You know it's going to get abused. You know there's all kinds of money going to be flooding in from all sorts of strange places, and no one's going to know where it's coming from. I just think it's terrible. I mean, it just feels like someone's gaming the system, and people already feel enough of that goes on.
Yeah, John Walsh, a former Democratic Party chairman for Massachusetts, says it's a huge sea change in the way political funding will be carried out in Massachusetts, and echoes your sentiment, Renee, saying it essentially eliminates the state's ability to set limits and standards on donations and the way money's spent in Massachusetts. Dante?
One of the causes of this is that there was a tension between federal and state, the federal and state legal procedures involved. And one thing we've seen since Citizens United and some related court decisions is that the entire federal campaign finance apparatus is kind of collapsing in a certain way. And here's an instance where I think that is also changing things on the state level.
Mm. It just throws campaign finance laws out the window. They've been completely defanged.
Well, interestingly, because Michael Sullivan, he's the director of the Office of Campaign and Political Finance, spoke to WBUR a little earlier today. And in fact, he said the decision was really about following existing law. So let's listen to him.
Well, I don't think we allowed them to do it. I think we had to follow federal law. I mean, federal law trumps state law in situations like this. The federal law basically says that if people do more than 25% of their time on federal matters, then they must be paid entirely from the federal account.
Not persuaded at all.
I don't feel good about this. No, I don't really agree with him on that. I mean, he's going to spin this the way he needs to, but I don't think the average voter is looking at this and thinking, oh, well, I understand how this works. They just feel, again, like the money is going to rule what happens in these elections. I mean, look how much, even in the presidential election, how much people are talking about money,
right,
and who, where it's coming from and who the donors are. Now we're going to be having these conversations on the state level, and I don't see how that helps anything.
Yeah, so it looks like, just for clarification here, the state cap on donations is $1,000 in annual limits, but if they follow this other cap, a political party is free to raise donations up to $10,000 under federal guidelines. So a tenfold difference,
right,
there. Dante, another thought on this?
Well, I just think that campaign finance law is about the most, or campaign finance practice is about the most negative example of innovation that you can find out there. Political campaigns of both parties will figure out exactly what they can do that is within the existing law and then do that. And I think you will soon see, now that the Republican Party has gotten clearance to do this, I would expect the Democrats to put their indignation down rather quickly and start doing the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm annoyed in a bipartisan kind of way, believe me.
A bipartisan, nonpartisan kind of way. All right, well, let's do one more little bit of news regarding Governor Charlie Baker. The National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce says it's dropping the governor from its annual gala later this month. The reason? One, the governor hasn't really thrown his weight yet behind a transgender protection bill pending at the State House. And this weekend, Baker is flying to Vegas to attend the Republican Jewish Coalition spring leadership meeting. And among other confirmed speakers at the meeting, Ted Cruz, Governor Rick Scott of Florida, and Pastor John Hagee, who back in the 90s gave a sermon that appeared to argue that the Holocaust was part of God's plan to push Jews back to the historic land of Israel. So, thoughts on whether or not Governor Baker should be attending this meeting in Las Vegas?
I'm going to go with no.
I'm throwing you the tough ones today.
I'm not really sure. No, I understand why he's going, but I don't think he should be going. And I think the group, the gay, lesbian, the GLBT group that was going to honor him is doing the right thing, because there's a sense that he's trying to have it both ways. You know, he's in Massachusetts and you've got this bill. He's doing absolutely nothing with it. And he's appearing with Rick Scott and Ted Cruz and Mr. Holocaust Revisionism. I just don't see the point of this. But, you know, this is what Charlie Baker, he has to figure out what kind of Republican he's going to be. Is he going to be the moderate Republican he thinks he is, or, you know, is he going to start to tack right, which means going off the cliff?
Hmm. Dante, what's your take on why the governor's going?
It's funny, because if I were Baker, I wouldn't want to be on a bill with this gentleman either. At the same time, you know, people are always surprised when Charlie Baker actually does things with other Republicans and, you know, does Republican things. And I don't think that we should be surprised by that. I mean, he's a Republican governor. He endorses other Republicans. So, the fact that he is going to such an event is not necessarily a surprise. It does speak to the fact that he's benefited, I think, from a certain level of constructive ambiguity in his politics. And this is one of those situations where it's a little difficult to have it both ways. And I think he's been on the transgender rights bill, he's been kind of letting it sort of slide and waiting to see which way it's going to come down, and, you know, putting off sort of playing his own cards. And I think, you know, this is the kind of thing that makes it tricky to do that over a period of time.
Constructive ambiguity. Can I use that in the future?
I just think he feels he's being pragmatic, but it's coming off as cowardly.
Hmm. Well, we've got just enough time for our hubbubs today, and those are the stories that didn't maybe make it to top of mind for the week, but deserve a mention anyway. So, Dante, let's start with you.
Well, okay, so trigger warning. My hubbub is a downer.
Okay.
This week, my colleague Derek Jackson, who is really, really into birds, reported... He's the puffin man. He reported on a very troubling find on this lake on the Maine-New Hampshire border. Some campers up there found a freshly deceased common loon, which, after being tested, turned out to have malaria. Now, avian malaria is different from human malaria, but what they both have in common is that they are mosquito-borne tropical diseases that generally are not found in northern New England. It's an obvious sign of a changing climate, but it's also symbolic. Now, the loon is on the Canadian dollar. There's Loon Mountain in New Hampshire. It's emblematic of northern lifestyles, and the fact that there's malaria turning up in loons in New Hampshire is a disturbing sign.
Very, and they have one of my favorite calls of any bird in the world.
That's... Can you do it?
No. I have too much respect for birders and loons to even try.
And radio listeners.
And radio listeners. Well, this is a terrible story, Dante. Yes, thank you for the trigger warning, by the way. So, Renee, your hubbub?
I'm staying on the bird theme. I'm talking turkeys. And since it isn't Thanksgiving, I'm talking about those turkeys that are everywhere these days in Boston, Cambridge, Brookline, you name it. They are not afraid of dogs. They're not afraid of cars. They swagger down the street. They're like these sort of like gangster Tarantino turkeys that just take up all the sidewalk and terrify everyone. Boston Magazine called it Urban Turkey Armageddon. Pretty much.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen them yet, you will. You will not be able to miss them. And I personally think we need to prepare for our new turkey overlords.
The new turkey overlords. Yeah, I see them all the time. They chase people. I live along the Green Line on the Sea Branch. They chase people onto the trains, actually.
I've seen them push joggers into the street. Dogs bark. They do nothing. It's like, what is this? Where did they come from? It's not fun.
It's definitely not fun. So the wild returns.
Yeah.
Urban turkey overlords. Okay.
Yes.
Well, usually I bring an animal-related hub or a ridiculous science-related hubbub to the table here, but today I'm actually going to end with some good news a little, because I wanted to mention that Adrienne Haslett, who is one of the victims of the Boston Marathon bombing who lost her leg, she's going to run the marathon this year, the full 26.2 miles. She expects, you'll remember that last year, I believe, she actually did a waltz across the finish line in high heels and a beautiful dress because she is a dance instructor. This year, she's going to run the whole event. She thinks it's probably going to take her maybe 6.5-7 hours because she's got to do some pit stops to adjust her running prosthetic leg. But she's going to do it and donate all the money to an organization that helps people who need prosthetic limbs. It's just a great story and exactly the kind of toughness and inspiration I think we all need. So go, Adrienne, in this year's marathon. That is my hubbub for today. So, Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe. Always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Dante Ramos, also columnist for the Boston Globe. We got the dual columnist and dueling for a time there. Globe columnist today. Dante, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for our hubbub. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.